Welcome to the Full Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording. It's 1:16 p.m. that is Pacific Standard Time. Today is January 17th, today being Friday. It's the big picture, long-term audio and video for the various different asset classes. Should also mention that it's a holiday on Monday here in the USA. I usually work the holidays, but my daughters are competing in the morning, and competing in a fencing competition on Monday morning, and I may may not have time to post, or it would be a brief post that I create on Monday afternoon. When we look at markets, then we can see that we've had a really quite impressive advance, and that is being led by the largest companies in the world. And when we look at, for example, Apple, the share has doubled in the course of the last 12 months. And it was at another new high in here today. And this is rather extraordinary for the largest companies in the world to represent by far some of the clearest patterns of outperformance. So this kind of acceleration does not last indefinitely. It is sucking in money from all over the world, and eventually it will have consumed as much liquidity as is sitting out there, with a willingness to continue to pay all-time new highs for the largest companies in the world. And at that point, we'll probably get some mean reversion. What does mean reversion really mean? Well, from the perspective of a longer-term investor, what I find particularly interesting with Apple is that since the lows put in all the way back in about 2003, it has found support in the region of the 1,000 and have taken a little bit of extra time in which to complete that mean reversion. But I think the important point here is that Apple is a share that is capable of halving and still being in a bull market overall. But then let's take a look at the PE ratio. We certainly have these spiky occasions when you do get strife, and it contributes to a rather choppy chart. But I think the most important thing is that, let's just say that from the beginning of 2009, this is the highest PE we've had. There have been periods when the PE was higher and lower over the course of this long range, but this is a very clear breakout. And what it helps to ram home is that valuations are increasing, and that we're going to have to see a clear and sustained recovery in the global economy if the valuation is to be justified. Right now, the stock market is pricing in an aggressive growth area. When we then think about what that is likely to represent, well, we can obviously think about where are the engines of global growth. Well, the US is obviously one of them, being the largest economy in the world and still growing. China is another. And what happens in China is obviously going to have an impact. The end of the trade war is obviously one of the things that is helping to stoke investor interest. But there are other factors, and the continued supply of liquidity from the world's central banks is also a very important factor. We've also seen, for example, that Microsoft's PE ratio has been rising steadily since its breakout from its long-term range in 2012. What this does suggest is that the adoption of the subscription business model, and this is something we've seen with a considerable number of other shares, has been that the reliability of the cash flows has justified the higher multiple that investors are willing to pay because they feel like they have better visibility on what value, on what earnings are likely to be. But Microsoft is now trading at an estimated PE of 33. It hasn't traded at anything approaching that level since 2003. And of course, it is a very different company today than it was back then, but certainly the trajectory of valuations is looking higher. Well, then if we think about the overall market, the S&P 500 is trading on a multiple of about 22. Again, this is also rather choppy in terms of the valuations. And certainly we can see that there was a very clear trajectory. If we set aside for a moment the spikes, which coincided with recessions and dislocations in the market like 1987, but rather look at the trajectory of valuations over the course of the period from 1980 all the way through to the peak in 2000, well, it was clearly upwards. And we're seeing something similar now. Since about 2011, the trajectory of valuations has been moving higher. And the move that we've had quite recently, really over the last year, has been to unwind the swift compression in valuations we had in terms of that big pullback in December of 2018. So what, in other words, the market is starting to predict is that we're going to move back into a period of synchronized global economic expansion similar to what we had in 2017. At least that was what prevailed before we had the dislocations in the market that started immediately after Jay Powell was appointed the head of the Federal Reserve in January of 2018. When we then think about what is it that central banks are doing? Well, I think it's appropriate to start off by looking at the total assets of central banks. And for a brief period this week, it did hit 20 trillion. And it's currently sitting just below that. And part of the reason that we've had the pop above 20 trillion and the move since the beginning of September of adding $800 billion in terms of central bank accommodation. That's, I think, a big number. What it very clearly highlights is that the Federal Reserve might have added $400 billion, but there was another $400 billion came from other central banks. And we're back in the region of the upper side of the range, and that there was an important peak at the beginning of 2019. We had a meaningful infusion of liquidity right at the end of 2018 to stem the panicky environment that prevailed in the stock market at the time. I'm posting a video today that was posted by Double Line, and it's got a number of front page name economists on the panel. David Rosenberg, who generally has a more bearish view, Ed Hyman, who generally has a more optimistic view, Jeff Gundlach, who tends to be more market driven, Danielle DiMartino Booth, who I don't believe did a particularly good job of putting her view across, but she does give some really good insights on the way that the Federal Reserve thinks and makes decisions. There was one point that she made which I thought was particularly interesting, which is that the reason the Federal Reserve uses the PCE inflation measure, which is massively understating inflation. Well, the reason they do that is because all their models would break if they stopped using it. In other words, they've painted themselves into a corner. And that's, I think, an important fact. Healthcare expense, for example, is trending higher in a rather profound manner. And this is something that normal people have to bear, but it doesn't seem to figure in terms of the central bank's calculations. There are problems that are sitting out there that could potentially have an impact on the markets, and probably will have an impact on the markets eventually. The fact that half of all investment grade debt is rated BBB, and that a substantial quantity of that debt has the potential to be downgraded, well, that does obviously have a, that represents a potential issue for high yield spreads, because if the quantity of debt in the high yield sector increases, then that would suggest that the price should fall and therefore yields rise. But that is, there is no evidence that there's any real stress in this market at present. In fact, it continues to rally really quite impressively, and the high yield sector has completely unwound all of the pop on the upside we saw in the last quarter of 2018. We really would need to see a sustained move above 5% in order to really question that we're not still in a liquidity-fueled environment. When we look then at the the Fed's balance sheet, it has been rallying really quite impressively over the course of the last 4 months. When we think about the correlation between the continued advance that we're seeing on the stock market and the clear accelerations that we're seeing in large cap shares, whether that is Apple or Microsoft or indeed Tesla, then it's largely attributable to the clear provision of liquidity. What's, I think, somewhat different on this occasion is that I think everybody now is getting the message that the provision of liquidity is a clear focus for investors, and that it affords investors the potential to continue to bet on speculative issues. What it basically is telling investors is the Fed's got your back. When the high yield sector seized up at the end of 2018, well, one of the shares that pulled back most violently was Tesla, because their debt is very clearly in high yield territory. So I think that's a rather interesting phenomenon. And then you have the fact that when we've had a very clear, we can see the bond rating for Tesla is still a CCC+, so it couldn't be more clearly in the high risk environment. And yet the share price has benefited incredibly from the volatility that it provides, going from under $200 in the second quarter of 2019 to over $500 right now. There is obviously a clear risk of some consolidation here. And this, I think, is one of the more important facts, that we are quite likely to see some process of mean reversion unfolding, not least because we have very clear evidence of acceleration. And acceleration is a trend ending. It's an ending of undetermined duration, but the clear hoovering up of available demand is unsustainable beyond the short term, and it does suggest that there is the potential that we could see quite a lot of the really quite incredible advance that we've seen in some of these shares unwound in a rather abrupt manner. There is obviously then, when we look at the very impressive breakouts we've seen on the NASDAQ, for example, we had a lengthy period of ranging, and ranges are explosions waiting to happen. When we look back at how this unfolded, for example, in 2015 and 16, the market broke out and then just kept going. When we go back then and think about the range that persisted in 2011 and 12, well, it broke out towards the end of 2012 and then it just kept going. So investors have been conditioned to expect that when we get a breakout from one of these ranges, it will just keep going. And I think this is by far the most important point, is that the risk of mean reversion is increasing. But the massive infusions of liquidity that the central banks are providing is greatly increasing bubble risk. If we get these accelerating trends moving into a true mania, then that is going to be a clear trend-ending characteristic, not simply for a mean reversion, but potentially for the longer-term bull market, for the simple reason that a bubbly environment will force the Fed to start to withdraw liquidity. And of course, leverage in the system will have then increased substantially after that. So it will become even more sensitive. And what we've had over the course of the last 12 months have been warning shots. We've had the seizing up of the high yield market, and the issuance in high yield is still really very low. And we know that there is that looming issue of fallen angels. Then we had the seizing up of the repo markets in September, and that was what preceded the massive infusions of liquidity that we had from the Federal Reserve, which remain underway. As long as they remain underway, then we are likely to continue to see this bid under asset prices, because after a 10-year bull market, everybody gets the message. The quantity of money that is being invested in passive funds or ETFs continues to increase. It was another one of the statistics in that roundtable was that it was upwards of 90% was flowing through ETFs. Well, one of the most important characteristics in the latter stages of all bull markets is the adoption of an earnings agnostic strategy. Now, in this cycle, it's the move into ETFs, because people have given up on trying to outperform the market, and the market has been doing spectacularly well because it has been fueled by the rise of liquidity from central banks. During the mania that we had in the late 1990s, it was because earnings don't matter. And when earnings don't matter, well, then obviously you're deploying an earnings agnostic strategy, because you're betting on the continuation of the trend and the fact that companies are just out there to increase their market share. But what, of course, it also represents is this momentum strategy. And ETFs, because they're earnings agnostic, generally they have an imputed momentum element to all of them, because stock market indices are market cap weighted. They represent the continued flow of money into ETFs, represents a further concentration of assets in the world's largest companies. That's part of the reason why Apple and Microsoft are accelerating higher. It's also part of the reason why Google has been accelerating on the upside. And it was up in very clear, emphatic territory again in here today. The wallflower in terms of the mega caps has been Amazon, and it was in negative territory in here today. Now, this is quite different. One has to ask the question, why is Amazon not breaking on the upside? It's a cloud provider, but of course it is now getting increasing competition from both Google and Microsoft for its cloud business. And the threat of antitrust for Amazon is probably greater than some of the other companies, because it is so dominant in terms of the e-commerce sector. It's also heavily reliant on the health of the consumer. So the fact that Amazon is not breaking on the upside, that does suggest that we do need to be looking at the plumbing of the economy. Now, what I thought was interesting is when we look at jobless claims, then simply at looking at the trend, we can see that there has been a loss of downward momentum, and it seems to be difficult now for the economy to drop below 200,000 jobs. So I think that's meaningful, because what it suggests is we are potentially now in the bottoming phase. Now, if we look at continuing claims, one of the reasons why we can't see and I'm just going to take the non-seasonally adjusted for the moment, we can see that it has broken its sequence of lower rally highs. And when we look at seasonally adjusted data, then it has very clearly broken its sequence of lower rally highs. Well, you can't really have a recession without people losing their jobs. This type of activity, where we're starting to see higher reaction lows and the potential for base formation completion in jobless data, it doesn't give us a very clear indication yet that we're moving into a recession. But it would have to pull back rather quickly in order to defray the potential that is what we're looking at. We can see that jobless claims, continuing claims, pretty much started going sideways rather than down from the middle of 2006 through to 2007, and then they broke out. If we were to see this move above the 2000 mark on this chart, which I believe coincides with 2 million continuing claims, then I think that would be a clear indication that we are on the front end of a recession. So this, I think, is something that we need to pay particular attention to. And that's why I think Boeing is very important, because they are really looking at some very significant problems. And this is obviously a potential issue, not only because Boeing itself is the employer for 150,000 highly paid people, but also because of the ecosystem that relies on the relative health of Boeing. But the much bigger picture is the financialization that GE invented, or the financial engineering that they invented, has permeated a significant portion of the industrial base. And there is the real potential now that Boeing is going to represent another General Electric type issue. When we go back and think about the release of the Dreamliner, they had to go back to the drawing board and fix some of the niggly issues. And that plane was delivered 4 years late, and it still had problems. What they've instead done with the MAX is deliver it on time, but in order to do that, they basically cut corners left and right. They did not design a new fuselage. They bolted new engines onto the old fuselage, but those engines are much larger. They had to sit higher up on the body of the plane. That affected its aerodynamics. In order to combat that, they created a software system. They didn't train people on the software system. The relationship between the engineers and management has degraded not least since they moved the corporate headquarters to Chicago and left all the engineers in Seattle. This share has Type 3 top formation characteristics, and it went from being one of the best performers in 2017 and almost breaking on the upside in an emphatic fashion right at the beginning of 2019 to being a serial underperformer. There is the clear potential here that Boeing is going to have a lot more problems. And a number of its suppliers are already in dire straits. What that suggests is this does represent a risk, and it represents a risk in terms of joblessness. And it is the health of the U.S. consumer is the basic condition on which the entire bull market is predicated. So there is obviously a clear incentive by the Federal Reserve to continue to boost their liquidity. Now, we know that the Fed funds rate is about 1.75%, but the lower bound is 1.5%. 3-month yields are 1.54%. And when we then look at the yield curve, we can see, for example, that we have 1.54% or 5.5% on the 3-year, and we go all the way out to 5 years, and we've only risen by 7 basis points. Bond investors are not willing to bet that we're going to see any kind of move higher in terms of inflation. But, and I'm just going to cough, excuse me. What we are definitely seeing right now is the monetization of debts. If the Federal Reserve is buying up the short end of the curve and intentionally depressing yields at the short end of the curve, well, they're trying to get a steeper yield curve, and they have succeeded. The yield curve spread is still reasonably modest, because 10-year yields are only at about 1.8%. So a less than 30%, a 30 basis point spread between the 10 and the 2-year is not going to be particularly alarming for markets. Of course, what the risk is that by continuing to try and affect both ends of the yield curve, that the Federal Reserve is in very dangerous territory. The clear move to go from responding to bursting bubbles to actively trying to support markets and in the process blow bubbles is one of the kinds of mistakes that lead to market crashes. This is, I think, one of the more important points. When we get acceleration in markets, when we get the potential, the kind of leverage that has been built up, there is so many different ways in which we've seen malinvestment in this cycle. We know that the kind of activities that have been going on in Boeing, where the industrial heart of the company has been gutted in order to fund the share buybacks and the compensation program for the senior executives, that's not the kind of condition that can persist indefinitely. It does suggest that there is clear risk of that problem metastasizing. It's exactly the same kind of thing that happened at General Electric. Then that is also present in a significant number of other companies, where the investment in research and development and capital expenditure has been subsumed by investment in buying back stock. And this buying back of stock is justified because interest rates are low. If we ever get an inflation scare, then it's likely to have a deleterious effect on yields, but most particularly every time we've seen a pop in yields, it has contributed to stress in the wider economy and the market. Therefore, we know that there are issues out there. What we need to pay attention to is the continued willingness of the Federal Reserve to both cut interest rates and continue to expand the size of its balance sheet. I do think that it is more likely than not that is exactly what they're going to do. The only other central bank that has ever tried to take a trillion out of circulation was the ECB, and they basically created deflation. And we had a meaningful growth scare in the USA last year. There are a significant number of people worried about the trajectory of growth this year. And the ECB's response to that deflationary scare in 2014, having taken a trillion out of circulation, they put back in 2.6 trillion. What that suggests is that the Federal Reserve's response to any impending growth scare is going to be to massively increase the size of their balance sheet. And it suggests that we could see the size of the balance sheet approach anywhere from 6 to 7 trillion in any kind of growth scare environment. The break of trend we've seen in response to the repo crisis is just the thin end of the wedge. The Federal Reserve and central banks globally are terrified of the next recession. They know that they're not going to be able to cut interest rates the same way they've done historically. They just haven't been able to generate the kind of runway in order to do that. What that suggests is they're going to try and forestall the next recession for as long as possible. But in order to do that, they're going to have to buy a bull market. And that is going to require massive infusions of liquidity. We've really only seen $400 billion by the Fed and another $400 billion by other central banks, but that is likely to persist. Then we should also pay attention to the trade war and China, because China's economic growth is continuing to slow and non-performing loans continue to rise. And in 2019, they were about 2.4 trillion yen, yuan. And that's a lot of money. The one thing, and it is the is completely unknowable, we simply have no idea what it is the natural default rate of a Chinese company. In the USA, we have lots of history, and there are ample examples of the economy moving through these periods of recession and otherwise. We just don't have that kind of data for China. The banking sector tends to be heavily influenced by government policy and heavily reliant on the willingness of the government to continue to stimulate and support the infrastructure sector and the basic resources sector. Banks have so far not been able to sustain a move up and out of the range. The response of US markets to the signed trade deal has been nothing short of euphoric, because it's been associated with massive accommodation in terms of central bank activity. The response of Chinese markets to the same trade deal have been much more muted, not least because there is a view domestically that China has lost out. I think it is hard to argue with that conclusion, and the policing mechanism that has been introduced is something that China is going to have to work around in one way or another. The internal divisions that have been arising in China, not least because of the increasing social unrest, not least in Xinjiang, but also the response to the massive surveillance efforts that have been imposed over the course of the last few years, and the very real parallels with 1984. These are obviously challenges for the administration, but there is another way of thinking about it, is that domestic unrest is more a symptom of slowing economic growth and the failure of the party to continue to supply progressively better living standards represents a real threat to their legitimacy. So it's rather imperative that the banks sector find support in the region of the trend mean. China represents an existential threat to the global economy if it were to slow very meaningfully. The trajectory of the official data is certainly deteriorating. What China needs is stimulus, and so far the government has been rather reluctant to pull on the traditional levers of support. That may change this year as we move and as they look towards 2021 and the 100-year anniversary of the founding of the communist regime. There is that obviously is a potential support for the market, but we don't yet really have evidence that that is underway. Meanwhile, the renminbi continues to strengthen, so that is certainly a response to the potential here that they're going to follow through on some of the demands that have been imposed through the deal. This now looks like a very clear failed downside break below 7. It's clearly potential here for additional upside by the renminbi. The Federal Reserve is by far the most active in terms of the global central banks, but the interest rate differential that the US continues to benefit from is representing a support for the dollar. When we look at what could potentially stoke a selling pressure for the dollar, it would be slower economic growth. We already have massive monetary accommodation and lower interest rates. The continued outperformance of the US market and the relative advantage of picking up a yield on US bonds is one of the factors behind the continued strength of the dollar. It is now testing its sequence of lower rally highs. The downtrend that began in October coincides very neatly with the expansion of the balance sheet. So it would need to clearly sustain a move above that moving average in order to suggest that we're back in a demand-dominated environment. I think one of the clear conclusions that we can draw is the relative strength of gold, and it's so far its clear ability to continue to hold this $1,550 area. That is a direct response to the demand for a hedge against the worst instincts of central banks. News over the Christmas holiday that Germany is imposing a requirement that any purchase of gold more than 2,000 euro needs to be reported is a further extension of the war on cash. And the one clear benefit of gold is they cannot be printed into existence. The response of central banks to the misallocation of capital and malinvestment over the course of the last decade, the fact that we have more companies that are unlikely to ever make a profit listing today than even in the 1990s, is a testament to the malinvestment that's occurred. Of course, we have also had good investment. The the success of Tesla, for example, despite the fact that it is massively overextended at present in revolutionizing the automotive sector, certainly is a direct response to the massive availability of cheap liquidity that occurred over the course of the last decade. I do think that is now about to take an additional iteration, with the potential that Foxconn or Hon-Hai Precision is going to start manufacturing cars. This is going to be transformational for the automotive sector, and not all automotive companies are going to survive. When you commoditize the vehicle, it throws all of the focus onto the added extras, the user interface, the entertainment, and the potential for autonomy. All of those factors become much more important when the construction of the car becomes commoditized. And those are not the natural wheelhouse of the engineering companies and manufacturers that have got huge sunk costs in production facilities all over Europe in particular, but also in the USA. So this does represent an existential threat, particularly to Europe, where reliance on the automotive sector is probably more acute than elsewhere. And Foxconn has got first step above the base characteristics, considering the trade deal has been signed and the potential that it is going to move into much more higher value production, and starting off with production in China. This does represent a very important change to the overall environment. And that potential for much more demand for and supply indeed of electric cars is helping to change the outlook for the lithium miners, who had been trending downwards for most of the last 2 years. Now we're seeing an increasing number of those exhibit clear commonality, and they're breaking their relative downtrends. So that's, I think, a clear response to the change that we're getting in the automotive sector generally. This is going to represent incredible disruption. It is going to bring back into focus the argument about how technology is going to eradicate jobs. The simple reality is that we have two examples here. We have the Boeing example, where mismanagement is going to eradicate jobs. And then we have the technological innovation argument, which is going to eradicate some jobs and create other jobs. That's probably going to be a net-net loss in terms of overall wages, but is a part and parcel of the rise of technological innovation as a very real and persistent trend. I think one of the clearest conclusions that we can draw, particularly with the continued move we're seeing in the stock market, is bond yields have been relatively contained. A sustained move above 2% would really be required to signal that we're back in a supply-dominated environment. So far, we haven't quite seen that, but we've definitely seen more dynamic moves starting to come through, and this does have the look of a bottom, certainly similar to what we saw in 2016 and 2012. There is obviously a lot at stake here. Gold looks like it's on a recovery trajectory. It looks like there is clear evidence that investors are starting to look at gold more favorably. They're looking for a hedge because the clearest intention of central banks is to devalue their respective currencies in order to try and combat the massive quantity of debt that's built up. And that is an undeniable trend. Then how does one protect purchasing power? Well, there is really only two ways. You either have to get out of the financial system entirely, which is the almost atomic route, and that is to buy gold. The alternative is to jump on the bandwagon and pursue the volatility, the low volatility and high momentum strategies. And that is what the vast majority of ETF investors are engaged in. But the clear potential here is that as valuations increase, the clear scope is for an acceleration and a mania to evolve. And I think we already have evidence of a mania in the private equity sector. I've talked quite a lot about this over the last year, but the quantity of money that is trying to get in on the act by buying early stage companies before they ever come to market, and that is obviously assuming that they're unlikely to have profits in the early stage. It's really always talking about market share and trying to capture value. That's extraordinarily similar to what we had in the late 1990s. And there is already evidence that these companies are unlikely to ever really have profits. I think among those certainly has to be Uber, but it is benefiting right now from the continued provision of liquidity. Netflix announced spending plans of something in the order of $17 billion for 2020 to produce new shows. Well, it's got a market cap today of $148 billion, and it's got a PE of 100 on an estimated full year 2020 basis. But this trend has lost consistency. It also represents a Type 3 potential top formation, although it is now on the upward swing from the lower side of the range. The concentration of portfolios in either the large cap companies or those that have represented the most fashionable of the new growth companies is something that we need to pay attention to. There is, I think we are in the bubble phase. We're going to see the markets potentially do a lot better than anyone thought possible. That people are going to lose the run of themselves, and it is going to be fueled by central banks panicking about the prospect of a recession. That is probably going to create a problem that's much larger in the future, but we're probably not there yet. And there is, if we're at the beginning of the acceleration phase, then it's likely to go farther and faster than anyone thought possible. And the move we've had in palladium, I think, is a perfect example of that. It looked like it had already done a lot at the beginning of 2019, and since then, it's up another 50%. So this is also looking really quite overbought. It's also looking like it has gone probably far enough in the short term, and we are due at least another consolidation. One thing on the technology front that I find rather interesting is that platinum has now sustained a move above $1,000 for the first time in about 4 years. Now, obviously, it has to hold it, but the continued move that we're starting to see in demand for hydrogen fuel cells and demand for hydrogen related stocks is helping to support the platinum price because of the requirement for platinum as a catalyst in the majority of hydrogen fuel cells. So there's evidence here of a number of the technologically influenced oversold markets starting to outperform. We're also starting to see that the broader commodity complex has been firming and was in positive territory again today. The LME Metals Index has been pushing up and out of its range. So we're starting to see that there is some traction for the reflation trade. Generally speaking, it is in the latter stages of a bull market that you get cyclicals doing particularly well. On this occasion, it's more than likely going to be the battery producers and the hydrogen sector that is going to be the clear mover because of the transition technologically that we're getting in the transportation sector. It may not necessarily be the iron ore market, although the iron ore market was firming in here this week, because I say that because China is not going to be pulling the same kind of infrastructure development that it did a decade ago. They've already built a lot of the infrastructure they require. Whereas the changes that we're getting in the global automotive sector and transportation generally are completely new and profound. What that suggests is that we are likely to have a commodity renaissance, but probably limited to those that are particularly influenced by that new trend. But again, that is representative of the continued outperformance of cyclicals well into the peak of a medium-term bull market. And that really only is starting now. So I think that we are late in the cycle, and the liquidity on which the market really is fueled continues. We have, I think, increasingly large risks of a reversion to the mean. The speed with which some of these shares have accelerated virtually ensures that it's unsustainable beyond the short term. The ability that they can demonstrate of finding support and holding the majority of their advances will be the real test of whether we're going to see these trends persist. I think with that, I will leave you for the weekend and wish all the best to all of you.